yesterday evening, we just did a little introduction to Sri Brahma Samhita, and I wanted to say a couple more things. Sometimes in the beginning of a book, there's an index. Like, for example, The Science of Self-Realization. In the beginning, there's an index, and it tells you what's inside the book. So, you can think of Sri Brahma Samhita as an index to Srimad Bhagavatam. The topics that are covered in Sri Brahma Samhita are an index to the topics of the 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam. As mentioned, they're sutra-like. They're very compact. So we'll make some effort to unpack and then put it back together again, the packed version. You can think of it also like a lens. I like to think of Sri Brahma Samhita like a lens through which you can see something that's really big. But this is a lens through which to see that. So the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, is big and complex. So to look at that big and complex in a way that it's not just a little piece over here, a little piece over there, but like what's the message? Sri Brahma Samhita helps. And those of you that have the patience and go through all of this will be then better prepared. When you're reading things from Srimad Bhagavatam, you'll have an understanding from Sri Brahma Samhita how they connect to the theme of Srimad Bhagavatam, or the theme of Brahma Samhita, how this connects with that in a theme-like manner. So, we'll begin with chanting the first verse of Brahma Samhita. We can chant it together. This is a verse that many devotees. How many devotees know this verse without looking? Most of the devotees. So, looking or not looking, let us chant together.
Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karanam.
And I'll read the translation.
Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Godhead. He has an eternal blissful spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, and he is the prime cause of all causes. So, in this morning's class, I'm going to give it a lot of thought to how to present this complex topic. And this morning's class will be in five parts. And I'll identify as we're moving from one part to the next part. So the first part is Paribhasha Sutra. What is it? What does it mean? How does it work? This verse is the Paribhasha Sutra for the whole book. So you have a photocopied version. Here's the BBT version. Pretty skinny little book. Looks like really easy. But it's very heavy. Because it expresses the nature of the Absolute Truth in a variety of ways. So,
I'm going to read a few things. This is from Jiva Goswami's definition, and I'll come back to it and expand the definition more. Paribhasha Sutra is a definition of terms or system of abbreviations placed in the beginning of a book, which must be understood in order to properly understand the remainder of the book. I'll give two examples. Probably you're familiar with them already. In Nectar of Devotion, it's a book that we study for Bhakti Shastri, one of the four essential books. In its Sanskrit form, Nectar Devotion is a summary study. And the Sanskrit form, the title is Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. And it's voluminous. And there is a Paribhasha Sutra for Nectar Devotion or Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. And that verse is a definition of bhakti, because the topic of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is devotion, about bhakti. So what is bhakti? That verse is the Paribhasha Sutra, and it has two parts to it. Anyabhilasha Chashunyam Jnanakarma Janabhatam Anukulyena Krishna Anushivanam Bhaktir Uttama. That's the verse that says what bhakti isn't and what bhakti is and how to cultivate it. And the rest is expanding that. It's further elaboration on that. And anything else that's in Nectar Devotion, you should understand it in terms of that. That one verse. Then another example, the example of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam has a Paribhasha Sutra. In his Krishna Sandarbha, this is the defining verse that establishes the whole of Krishna Sandarbha, because it establishes the whole of Srimad Bhagavatam. The whole 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam are pursuant to and governed by this one verse. Ete chamsa kalapamsam krishnas tu bhagavan swayam. That verse. In that verse it's stating specifically that of all the incarnations that have just been listed, one amongst them is the source of all of them. And Swayam Bhagavan Krishna is the source of all of them. And everything else, the other 18,000 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, are expanding that meaning. And so many other subjects are talked about for the purpose of expanding that meaning. Krishna is the source of everything. Now a little bit more about all of this. Paribhasha Sutra. When Vyasadeva compiled all the Vedas, he summarized them in sutra form, in Vedanta Sutra. And the opening message of Vedanta Sutra is, search for the Absolute. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur wrote a book, a collection of essays and articles on search for the Absolute. So, what's the Vedic definition of Absolute Truth? Here it is. According to Vedanta Sutra, that from which everything comes. Everything is an effect of that original cause. And that original cause has no cause. And that's what the verse is saying. Sarva karana karanam. He is the cause, he is the karana of all other karanas. Because things that are caused may themselves be the cause of something else, which is then the cause of something else, which is then the... An effect becomes a cause. Like, you know, like dominoes. One domino falls, and it hits the other domino, and that falls, and it falls, and it falls, and so on. So, when you see this domino fall into that domino, it looks like this is the cause, and that's the effect, which then becomes the cause of the next domino. But there's an original cause, the first domino that fell. And that's the cause of the other dominoes falling. So Krishna is the karana of all karanas. Or the absolute truth, I'd say. The absolute truth, that from which everything comes. And everything means everything. And that's what the message of Sri Brahma Samhita is. That absolute truth, sarva karana karanam, or... Could we have the picture again, please? I'd like to keep that, because I'm going to keep referring to it. So leave it like that. Anadir, he has no beginning. Adi means a beginning. And anadi means he has no beginning. But he is the beginning of everything else. From him everything else comes. Anadir, adir, Govinda. So, Paribhasya Sutra is a governing statement that comes at the beginning of a book or literature that defines the rest of the subject matter. And I'm going to read some additional things from Jiva Goswami's explanation of, mainly from Krishna Sandarbha, where he's explaining Srimad Bhagavatam's Paribhasya Sutra and what are the elements that make up such a verse. So he writes, it represents the totality of facts succinctly. It occurs early in the order of a literature. And the other statements in the literature elaborate its meaning. He indicates that it's a rule of interpretation. So let's say, what does that mean? Later on, something is said. Later on something is said, and you want to understand that something. To have a correct understanding of that something, it must match, whatever that understanding is, must match the Paribhasya Sutra. And if it doesn't, it's not a correct understanding. It's a rule of interpretation. It's the thesis of any book. So, what's the thesis or the theme, you know, in English literature that we take in school? Sometimes you have to write for the English teacher. What's the theme or the thesis of this book? Like, you know, Moby Dick. What's the theme or the thesis of Moby Dick? There's a storyline. There's a fisherman with a whaler, and there's a great white whale. You've got a name, Moby Dick. But what's the theme or the thesis of that book? So English students may have to answer their teacher and say, this is what I think the theme is. Paribhasya Sutra establishes this is the theme. That's a qualification. In his Jiva Goswami's commentary on Sri Brahma Samhita, he specifically states, this verse that's shown up here is the, it meets the qualifications of Paribhasya Sutra. Here's the Sanskrit in which he writes it. Tad uktam aniyame niyama kadani prabhasha iti. A Paribhasha Sutra explains the proper method for understanding a book. It gives the key by which one may understand the actual purport of a series of apparently unrelated facts and arguments. So, just consider. Here's one. A subject matter that we're going to be spending a fair amount of time diving into is creation. What's the purport? The purport is Krishna is the karana of all karanas involved in creation. There is no creation without Krishna. There may be causes that bring about effects. There are causes that bring about effects. Those causes will not bring about effects without the original cause. And to understand otherwise is, politely you can say, incomplete, and more firmly it's wrong. It's a wrong understanding. Cause and effect must be understood by the original, in terms of the original cause. Otherwise one's going to reach a wrong conclusion. We'll hear in just a moment. He writes further, Paribhasha Sutra is, it restricts to a particular usage that which is otherwise unrestricted. So there's, you know, a statement that's made over here, kind of like what people do sometimes with Prabhupada's. Prabhupada said, and there's a statement over here. And they use that to prove something that's their point of view, rather than understanding the context and the totality of statements that Prabhupada made on that topic. It's taken out of context. You've heard that expression. So that which may be interpreted this way, that way, or the other way, must be understood. The correct interpretation must be defined in terms of Paribhasha Sutra. Now, if one wants to know what anything is in Srimad Bhagavatam, or anything is in Nectar Devotion, or anything is in Sri Brahma Samhita, it must match the Paribhasha Sutra. But this verse is important, and therefore Jiva Goswami gives 13 pages of commentary on what you see up here. Paribhasha Sutra may thus govern the text, the contents of even a very large book, with millions of statements or arguments. It governs it. Then he gives an example in Panini's writing on Yoga Sutra. There's a particular verse, that's the Paribhasha Sutra. He states the verse. It's in classic or scriptural writing, it's an important concept, and the verse itself is an important verse, and this verse, according to Jiva Goswami, is the Paribhasha Sutra of this book, and as we heard yesterday, this is chapter 5 out of 100 chapters, and he states this chapter is the Paribhasha chapter of the other 99. So it's heavy, although, you know, it's skinny. It's very weighty. That's what we're doing. We don't have the other 99 even to look at or read. But just understand this one, this book, that this chapter, and it explains everything. Or it's the essence of everything. So that's the first part of five things I want to cover this morning. Announcing, I'm going on to the second part. The second part is what Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur says about this particular verse as the Paribhasha Sutra of Brahma Samhita, and what is it doing?
he says that the absolute truth, it's very simply put, the absolute truth is a person. The absolute truth, sarva karana karanam, that which, from which everything comes, that the absolute truth is the primal cause of everything, and that Govinda, specifically Krishna, but even more specifically here, Govinda is that cause, as exemplified in Brahma Samhita's Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Vajami. But it's not that it's only there and it's not in the other parts. It's there in the other parts also. One is to understand those other parts in terms of this. Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karana. In his foreword to this book, Brahma Samhita, Bhaktisiddhanta states the following in relation to this verse as the Paribhasha Sutra. He says that Lord Brahma, from the very outset at once, is putting full stop on the speculative approach to understanding God. We'll say it the other way. Without hearing in disciplic succession, in descending manner, one is left to speculate. And the speculative process is not going to reach this conclusion. He states, commonly there's one of two. One is, matter is the cause. This is called modern science. What's Prabhupada writes, an intelligent person will ask the question, and people, some intelligent people, ask the question in the wrong manner, by speculative method. And the conclusion they reach, not only in modern times, but even in Vedic times, even reading the Vedas by speculative method, they've reached the same conclusion the modern scientists have reached without reference to the Vedas. And that is, matter is the cause of everything. I mean, we've all gone to school, so we all know what it is. And here it is. There's only one thing. Matter. And the laws that govern matter, and there isn't anything else. Everything can be explained in terms of matter and the laws governing matter, and there isn't anything else. That's it. And we're supposed to get, grades in school by being able to say that back in an intelligent way. That's modern education. And the other is those that are using the speculative method and say, well, wait a minute, and whatever their various thought processes are, that from which everything comes is impersonal. In Bhaktisiddhanta's language, he calls it the entity beyond phenomena. So what's beyond this? It's definition by negation. What's beyond this? Well, it's not this, and 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 it's not this. So what is it? It's not this. It's impersonal. Here there's personal, here there's form, here there's variety. So where everything comes from must be not this. By speculative method, those are the two most prevalent common conclusions. And Bhaktisiddhanta is saying, immediately, Brahma is putting full stop. No. Neither impersonal, nor the cause of everything is matter and the laws governing matter, but the cause of everything is a supreme person, whose form is fully spiritual, Sachit Ananda Vigraha. And from him whose form is all spiritual, everything else comes. Now we hear, maybe you've not been so fortunate to hear, I have impersonalists who argue, why are you limiting God? By attributing to him form, this is their notion, form is limiting, and impersonal is unlimited. they do not know is that the form of Krishna is unlimited. The form of Krishna is all spiritual. There's no limiting aspect to it. I'm going to read, if you like, you can follow along, the second sentence of the purport of text number one. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur writes, very short sentence, the very name Krishna, in quotes, implies his love-attracting designation expressed by his eternal nomenclature, the acme of entity. He's got this interesting language. Acme is the topmost. He's the of all, and this word entity, we kind of use thing. But he's got another word, it's entity. So like Brahman is an entity, Paramatma is an entity, the form of Krishna Bhagavan is an entity, the table is an entity, you're an entity, and you know, something is an entity. So the acme of entity. The form of Krishna is the acme of entity, and the name Krishna is not different than Krishna, and Krishna is not different than the name, because he's absolute. And the person Krishna is not different than the acme of entity, because of the absolute nature of Krishna. So that's the application of Paribhasha Sutra through the whole of the message of Brahma Samhita. I just summarized. So, the next, this is the third part of five things I want to cover, is before going into unpacking Bhaktisiddhanta's language a little bit, because this verse is the Paribhasha Sutra, I'm going to do that a little bit with this first verse, and I'm not going to do it so much with the other verses. But before that, just like a little summary of what the verse or the verse and purport are saying. And it's a lot. Sri Krishna, the verse is saying, Krishna, his name, his form, and himself are eternal and all spiritual. The converse. There isn't a time when Krishna comes into being, as the impersonalists would like us to think. From the unborn comes Krishna. Not so. His very name, Krishna, means all attractive, and thus the topmost of all entities. So this is now Vishnu Purana. Bhagavan, Parashramoni says, Bhagavan means one who possesses all bhagas or opulences. Opulences attract people. Bhagavan possesses the opulences in full. Bhagavan, as the absolute truth, all attractive, the superlative attractive entity or being, is indicated by the name Krishna, and therefore he is the absolute truth. That's what's being, we'll go through the purport a bit more, but that's what's being said by this Paribhasa Sutra. In Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Gopal Tapani Upanishad from Atharva Veda, he makes a statement, because Gopal Tapani Upanishad speaks about Krishna. So he gives the following definition of Krishna and then adds to it a reference from Mahabharata that says the same thing. He says the name Krishna refers to the Supreme Person, whose spiritual form is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss. Exactly what's here. And to support that, he refers to the following verse from Mahabharata. The word or syllable Krish, K-R-S, is the all-attractive feature of the Lord's existence. Krish means to attract. Na means spiritual pleasure from the same root, ananda. Na refers to spiritual pleasure. When the verb krish, to attract, is added to the affix na, it becomes Krishna, which indicates the absolute truth. All attractive, Krishna, absolute truth. Now remember the meaning of absolute truth, that from which everything comes. He further, the verse from Mahabharata further says, the name Krishna may also be interpreted to mean the perfection of transcendental knowledge and bliss. So we've heard these things before. Why is this important? Right at the very beginning, this is being established. The import of all this is we are also part of that from which everything emanates. And everything around us that we experience and beyond our experience also emanates from that. Just we have an eternal connection, which by descending knowledge is being here disclosed, that absolute truth, which we all have connection with, and which everything has connection with, sambandha gyan, you're familiar with that term, the source of emanation has a relationship with all things, and if we can properly understand that relationship, then we can again act in that relationship. But if we don't properly understand that relationship, we'll act in ignorance, or act wrongly and foolishly, and do that which is not of our real self-interest. We do it all the time. I mean, the whole cosmic manifestation is made up of that. And to get out of the ignorance and the controlling powers of the illusory energy, understanding correctly the absolute truth, that from which we come, helps us get out of the miserable condition of material existence, and again restored in our spiritual position. Sambandha again is essential. Just to repeat that message in another way, in Harinam Chintamani, which is about the chanting of the holy name spoken by Haridas Thakur, he says that without proper sambandha gyan, one is not going to get the full effect of chanting. Chanting is the primary means of deliverance for the sage. Haridas Thakur says one must have proper sambandha gyan, knowledge of how everything is in relationship with the Supreme, in order to get the full effect of chanting. And chanting is deliverance, means, primary means of deliverance. So this is an important subject matter, because it will enable us, understanding it carefully, reasonably well, will help us perform our chanting in such a way we can get the full effect of chanting. So, in his explanation, commentary, Bhaktisiddhanta describes Krishna as carrying a flute. And we always, if you see some art that you're not so familiar with, and you see someone standing there holding his flute, that's Krishna, because Krishna is with his flute. And although Krishna has unlimited potency. Within Krishna, there's unlimited potency. Bhaktisiddhanta's language is that he makes himself accessible in a very nice medium size. Now, what does that mean, a medium size? By that, he means, just like the Ishopanishad or verse, Anor Iniyamsam Anusmared Yaha, he is bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest. And not only that, he is both at the same time. His all-expansive Brahman, or his form of Mahavishnu, how big is Mahavishnu? Inconceivably big. Because from the body of Mahavishnu, think of how tiny the pores of our skin are. Very, very tiny. Some perspiration may come out. But from Mahavishnu, his pores, although tiny in comparison to him, from the pores, universes come out. And according to the Vedas, our smallest of the universes' diameter is 8 billion miles. And that comes from one of the pores of his skin, or his transcendental body. How big is Mahavishnu? Try to make a garland for him, huh? And at the same time, he's smaller than the smallest. Not, he vacillates between big and small. He's simultaneously both. But Krishna is in this, so medium size means human-like. So we can make garlands and we can decorate him and we can do things like, we can do personal service for Krishna. And he makes this statement, he has instrumentals. Now I'm ahead of myself. And then that comes next. Bhaktisiddhanta's language. So, from him, in the purport, following Jiva Goswami's commentary, the Paramatma feature, or the Purusha avatars, in Bhaktisiddhanta's language, there is this term, subjective portion. And you'll hear it again and again. Subjective portion. It's not a psychological term. Like subjectivity. It's not. It's used in a different way. It's swangsa. These two terms. Swangsa and kala. Kala, we hear, is a portion of a plenary portion. That's Vishnu. A Sansa is Balaram, or Sankarshan in the spiritual sky. And then an expansion of that expansion is a Kala. So these expansions come from the Karanakaranam, Govinda. They're from him. Although their power, like one candle lit from another candle, has the same luminosity, same illumination power. Within Govinda, he's being the source, he holds a very special position, like the domino, the one domino that falls before the other dominoes fall. And he has qualities that surpass the qualities of the Svangsa or the Vibhinamsa. He's the powerhouse from which other power stations may come. He set up over here and over there. He generates all power. And the all-pervasive Brahman feature is also from him. It is but his effulgence. And so the special position of Krishna, or even more explicitly Govinda, as he's the basis of all of them. So he's the basis of the spiritual sky, he's the basis of the material creation, he is the rest and support of all things. So some of those all things are going to be discussed in Brahma Samhita. We are to remember from this Paribhasya Sutra, all of that is resting upon Krishna. We're also going to hear, starting verses 2 through 5, about Goloka. And this, just make reference to this nice chart over here. When you have time, take a look. I was at a GBC meeting in Juhu in the middle of October, and one devotee who I don't even know came and gave me a poster, and I said thank you, and I, you know, then I later looked at it, and I looked at it, and this is depicting Brahma Samhita. On the left hand side is text, but it's not just Brahma Samhita, it's Laghu Bhagavatamrita and Brihad Bhagavatamrita and Brahma Samhita. But in that verse, one of the verses from Brahma Samhita, the Govindam prayers, is stating the hierarchy. The top is Goloka Dham, then Hari Dham, and Mahesh Dham, and Devi Dham. And lots of detail. And the scriptural references that make up the basis of this, especially the Vaikuntha portion, is from Laghu Bhagavatamrita. But mainly the Goloka portion, because the subject of Sri Brahma Samhita is about the Goloka portion, where Krishna resides. Okay, so now moving along, the fourth topic is I'm going to spend a little bit of time. Maybe you've read the first verse already. Maybe you've read it 100 times and still found it puzzling because of Bhaktisiddhanta's language. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time with his language because of the importance of this verse. Here's just a few of his phrases. As his inconceivable spiritual energy is all extending, that's Krishna, still he maintains his all-charming medium size by his qualifying spiritual instrumentals. Instrumentals, it means his senses. His spiritual form has spiritual senses. And although he's all-powerful, one might think, well, gee, he's got to have a really big muscular body, you know, like Hercules or Atlas, or, you know, like somebody with big biceps and, you know, tough looking. One of Prabhupada's artists in the early stages of making paintings in the Hare Krishna movement, along with making Panchatattva paintings, Prabhupada asked one devotee in particular to make a painting of Narada Muni. And then they showed the painting to Prabhupada, and he looked like, you know, a big muscle guy. And Prabhupada laughed and said, he's not a meat eater. His body is slender. And the devotee said, well, I wanted people to be attracted because he's Narada Muni and he's very important. So I thought, you know, a big muscular guy, they'd be attracted. So no problem. He's already attracted to the all-attractive, and so he's attractive. That's his attractiveness. So paint him more slender next time. So, like Krishna entering into the wrestling arena with Chanur and Mushtika. You've seen the painting, the big muscular bodies, and here's this 12-year-old boy coming in with an elephant tusk over his shoulder, because he and Balaram just finished Kuvalya Pita, who is as big as 10 massive elephants. Huge! And just one destroyed Kuvalya Pita, along with beating with his elephant tusks. So one would think, you know, to defeat those two powerful wrestlers, he's got to be have big muscles. But he's got his medium size, and in the language of Bhaktisiddhanta, his conciliatory powers. He reconciles his all-powerfulness with a form that looks like ours. He makes those adjustments. Here's his language. His unrivaled or unique spiritual body of super excellent charm is eternally unveiled with innumerable spiritual instrumentals (parentheses senses) and unreckonable attributes. Achintya Shakti has inconceivable power, keeping their signifying location properly. In other words, doesn't have giant arms and big eyes. And, you know, it's not a monster. He looks like everything is adjusted very nicely. Although each one of his senses is interchangeably as powerful as any other sense. He adjusts everything very nicely. Adjusting the same by his inconceivable conciliative or reconciling powers. The mundane manifestive portion of his own self. Mundane manifestive portion means the Vishnu forms, Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, Shiradakshay Vishnu, those forms of the Lord that oversee the creation. They tend to the creation and maintain it. Those are the mundane manifestive portion of his own self, is known as all-pervading Paramatma, Ishvara, Supreme Lord, or Vishnu, all-fostering. Hence, it is evident that Krishna is sole Supreme Godhead. So these features of God within this world are expansions of Him. Therefore, He's the Supreme Godhead. While we may refer to them as Ishvara, He's Parameshvara. I'm just trying to help with his language. The concentrated all-time presence, uncovered knowledge, and inebriating felicity have their beauty in him. That's the Satchitananda Vigraha. It's his way of saying Satchitananda Vigraha. Eternity, knowledge, and bliss. Bliss is inebriating felicity. This beautiful spiritual figure is identical with Krishna, and the spiritual entity of Krishna is identical with his own figure. Krishna is absolute. Krishna and his form are the same. The form and Krishna are the same. Say it this way, say it that way. He's absolute. And absolute again, with this Vedic sense of from him everything comes. There's nothing material, there's nothing relative, there's nothing non-spiritual connected with his form, with his being. He's eternally existent in that way. And I'll just one last thing in this section. If you have your book, you can look at the last page or second to the last paragraph, where along with this verse describing Krishna's position, Bhaktisiddhanta speaks about creation. And it begins with, He is the root cause of all causes. You find that sentence in your purport. He is the root cause of all causes, who are the predominating and predominate TED agents of the universe. Someone is an Ishvara, and they're Ishvaras of some others. But that entity who is an Ishvara
has his Ishvara. He's the subject of some other powerful person. The glance of his projected fractional portion, that's Kala, portion of a plenary portion, that's Mahavishnu's glance, in the sacred originating water, that's the causal ocean, V-I-Z, namely, the personal oversoul or Paramatma gives rise to a secondary potency. What's that secondary potency? It's Maya. From glancing over Pradhan, the Mahatattva comes and the elements of Mahatattva are manifested. And then the show begins. So from him in the spiritual causal ocean, just by his glancing, the secondary energy comes. Nature, who creates this mundane universe, this oversoul's intermediate energy, so that's the jivas, the tatashta shakti, the jivas, this oversoul's intermediate energy brings forth the individual souls analogously to the emanated rays of the sun. So the sun has rays. Mahavishnu, by his glance upon Pradhan, the living entities are carried because they're within his body, and when he glances over Pradhan, they're carried and is compared to rays of the sun. Mahavishnu being the sun, the rays being the jiva souls being impregnated within Pradhan. So he's unpacking this, the sarvakarana karanam part, because it's going to be expanded upon in the next set of verses. Two through five. So that's unpacking some of Bhaktisiddhanta's language. And now, the last part of this morning's class is we're going to look at Jiva Goswami's commentary on this verse, some parts of it. Because, as I mentioned, it's a 13-page commentary. And what Jiva Goswami does is he takes each word and expands on the meaning of the word, takes the word, expands the meaning, and puts it back in the verse. Like, unpacks and then packs. Like you might do with your suitcase. You got a lot of stuff in your suitcase. You take some time to pack your suitcase. And then you get to where you're going and you unpack your suitcase and you start using this and that and the other thing. And then time to go and you put everything back in your suitcase. I do it all the time. So this is the unpacking and then the repacking by Jiva Goswami. And he starts with the word Ishvara, because it's the first word in the verse. Ishvara, put very simply, it means the supreme controller. And he discusses that. There's little controllers, and there's the supreme controller of those little controllers. And that's what's being spoken about in this verse. Because coming up, we're going to hear of different controllers. But we should understand they're under the control of the supreme controller. And then, in the word Parama, he says the following. He uses this classic methodology. He takes a word, he explains its meaning, and then he gives scriptural references to support how he explains its meaning. And he does it again and again. So here's with Parama. Para, the root, para, means supreme. And ma
literally means mother. And so he asserts Parama, Ishvara Parama, indicates that Krishna is always with his internal potencies, the goddesses of fortune or expansions, who are expansions of his internal potency. So Krishna with the gopis. So that's what he's saying, the connotation of the word Parama, Ishvara Parama, Krishna. So there's four scriptural references that he makes. One of them is from the Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 59, where it is stated, "Full of transcendental bliss, Lord Krishna enjoyed pastimes with the beautiful gopis who are all goddesses of fortune." So Ishvara Parama Krishna means Krishna with the gopis, who are goddesses of fortune. Then another 10th canto verse he refers to is the following one. When Lord Krishna was dancing with the gopis in the Rasa Lila, the gopis were embraced by the arms of the Lord. This transcendental favor was never bestowed upon the goddesses of fortune or the other consorts in the spiritual world. Indeed, never was such a thing imagined by the most beautiful girls in the heavenly planets, whose bodily luster and aroma resemble the lotus flower, and what to speak of worldly women who are very beautiful according to material estimation. So it's not only with goddesses of fortune, but goddesses of fortune in their relationship with Krishna are receiving the greatest of fortune. The goddesses of fortune are receiving from Krishna the greatest fortune, Ishvara Parama Krishna. Then another verse from the 10th canto. Although the son of Devaki, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is also the reservoir of all kinds of beauty, when he is among the gopis, he nonetheless becomes more beautiful, for he resembles a Marakata jewel surrounded by gold and other jewels. This is Jiva Goswami. Ishvara Parama. He's with the goddesses of fortune, and especially unlimited numbers of gopis. And the final reference is from Gopal Tapanika Upanishad. Lord Krishna is worshipped by the goddess of fortune. So Ishvara Parama. We've already discussed a little bit how he uses the term Krishna, the all-attractive, who gives, in his attractiveness, gives unlimited spiritual pleasure. So now he's going to discuss Govinda. And it's a long section, but I'll say it first in essence. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha. He says that Krishna appears in Mathura with four arms. That's Vasudeva Krishna. And then by his father, he's taken to Gokul, where he doesn't have four arms. He has two arms. And he has a flute. And there he's tending cows. And he's known as Govinda. And then later, Krishna, not Govinda, leaves Vrindavan and goes back to Mathura, and then goes to Dwaraka, and goes to so many other places. But Govinda never leaves the cows. He's always in Vrindavan. And when we get to that chart that you see on the right, or texts 2 through 5, especially 2 and 3, we're going to hear about the central part, the abode of Krishna, because the outer part that's in white around that lotus, that's Svetadvipa, where Mathura and Dwarka reside. And Krishna resides in those places of Mathura and Dwarka as Vasudeva Krishna. But the central part is where Govinda resides. and he never leaves there. And the residents never leave there. Even there may be Leela where it appears that they leave there, they never leave there. We'll discuss that a little bit later. But the subject of Brahma Samhita, this is the first verse, is that central part, Govinda. And Govinda refers to Govinda, he who satisfies or gives pleasure to the senses and the cows. So then he gives four scriptural references to support that interpretation of the meaning of Govinda. And for the first one, it's just like he's having spiritual enjoyment by making these references. You'll see. So it starts with chapter 27, which is the conclusion after the Govardhan Leela, Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill for 7 days, and then Surabhi and Indra come. And Surabhi offers prayers to Krishna, saying, actually, he's not our Indra, you are our Indra. And we want to call you Govinda. And when Shukadeva Goswami is narrating this pastime, he says, Shukadev says, may Lord Govinda, the king of the Surabhi cows, be pleased with us. So here's the verses from that section. Surabhi speaking, you are our worshipable deity. Therefore, O Lord of the universe, for the benefit of the cows, the brahmanas, the demigods, and all of the saintly persons, please become our Indra. As ordered by Lord Brahma, we shall perform your bathing ceremony to coronate you as Indra, our Lord. O soul of the universe, you descend to this world to relieve the burden of the earth. Then Shukadeva Goswami said, having thus appealed to Lord Krishna, Mother Surabhi performed her bathing ceremony with her own milk. And Indra, ordered by Aditi and other mothers of the demigods, anointed the Lord with heavenly Ganga water from the trunk of Indra's elephant carrier, Airavata. Thus, in the company of the demigods and great sages, Indra coronated Lord Krishna, the descendant of Dashara, and gave him the name Govinda. That's one of the imports of the meaning of Govinda, Ishvara Parama, Krishna Sachit, Ananda Vigraha, Anadir Adir. Govinda is that person. He who is at the center of that lotus, in the yellow part in the middle. And we're going to hear the next verse about that, next two verses about that yellow part in the middle. And then the pinkish petals surrounding the yellow part in the middle. But he's the one that's being described in Brahma Samhita. The next reference, Jiva Goswami gives in his commentary, is from the Gosukta, where it says, quote, Vedic yajnas are performed to worship the cows. The demigods rise out of respect for the cows. Four Vedas, six Vedangas, and the Pada method of recitation are all manifested from the cows. And Krishna is the one who gives pleasure to the cows. So this name Govinda indicates that person. It says, we were in Vrindavan during Kartik, a number of us were. And on Gopastami Day, it's a very, very
popular day throughout all of Vrindavan for worshipping the cows and all these things. So many things are recited beyond what we just recited. Well, the cow is the residential place, the body of a cow is the residential place of all auspicious things. And so the auspicious things are being worshipped by the worship of cows. Dinabandhu was saying, we made our schedule. He advised us to make our schedule in such a way we didn't go to Ter Kadamba on Gopastami Day. Because he said there's thousands and thousands and thousands of people doing thousands and thousands and thousands of Gopujas all over the area. We would have just been mobbed. And on Gopastami Day, Govardhan Puja, Govardhan Parikrama, is participated in, according to the devotee who was with us, who has been in Vrindavan for 15 years, and has done Govardhan Parikrama on Gopastami Day during the month of Kartik, is an estimated 10 million people that do Govardhan Parikrama on Gopastami Day. Now, how many people? What's the population of Seattle?
2.2
million. Could you imagine, you know, four Seattles going around Govardhan Hill in one day, the same day? I can't imagine it. I mean, just in terms of numbers, but to speak of sentiments of people. Maybe it's an exaggerated number, but that's the estimated number. That's a lot of people. Can you imagine how crowded it is? On Ekadashi Day, during the month of Kartik, I don't know what it's like during other times, but during the month of Kartik, just around going around Vrindavan town on Ekadashi Day, it's literally wall-to-wall people. I mean, I don't know how to describe it other than saying rush hour, going in and out of the subways in New York all day long. It's like, you know, about 20 people abreast, side by side, all the way around Vrindavan town, or maybe like a football game. You just think of a lot of people going into the game or coming out of the game, or a baseball game or whatever, attracts a lot of people around here. All day long, going around Govardhan Hill, going around Vrindavan town. So, and what's the basis of that? It's the all-attractiveness of the all-attractive. On Gopastami Day especially, because that's the day that Sanatana Goswami departed from this world. And Sanatana Goswami, during the final stages of his life, was living at Manasi Ganga, and every day would do Govardhan Parikrama until he was 80 years old. And he left his body on Gopastami Day, and so they took his body on Parikrama around Govardhan Hill, and then in procession back to Vrindavan town, and established his samadhi by the side of the Madan Mohan temple. So in honor of Sanatana Goswami, whatever the number is, 10 million people do Govardhan Parikrama on Gopastami Day. So the cows are really important. And Krishna is Govinda, is he who gives pleasure and satisfies the cows. They're very dear to him, and he is very dear to them. Then another reference from Gopal Tapani Upanishad. Lord Brahma himself declares in Gopal Tapani Upanishad, by offering prayers in the company of the Maruts and other demigods, I always please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Govinda, whose form is eternal and full of knowledge and bliss, and who sits beneath the Kalpa Vriksha tree. So you notice, if you look closely, that yellow part is at the center of Goloka or Gokula. There's a tree. under which Radha and Krishna are standing. Gopaltakuti Upanishad. Because the trees in Vrindavan are Kalpavriksha trees, with any trees. And the final reference, the glorious Surabhi cows and other residents of Vrindavan are glorified by Lord Brahma in the following verse, and this is the conclusion. My dear Lord, this is Brahma praying to Krishna, chapter 14, after stealing the calves and cows, the Brahma Vimohan Leela. I am most humbly praying at your lotus feet for you to please give me any sort of birth within this Vrindavan forest, so that I may be able to be favored by the dust of the feet of some of the devotees of Vrindavan, even if I am given the chance to grow just as a humble grass in this land. That will be a glorious birth for me. But if I am not so fortunate to take birth within the forest of Vrindavan, I beg to be allowed to take birth outside the immediate area of Vrindavan, so that when the devotees go out, they will walk over me. Even that would be a great fortune for me. I am just aspiring for a birth in which I will be smeared by the dust of the devotees' feet. I can see that everyone here is simply full of Krishna consciousness. They do not know anything but Mukunda. All the Vedas are indeed searching after the lotus feet of Krishna. So there's our introductory verse for Sri Brahma Samhita. The Paribhasha Sutra, the one who is establishing Krishna as the absolute truth, and specifically Govinda, he who resides in Vrindavan eternally, playing upon his flute, tending the cows, and doing all these nice things in his medium size, human-like, not big, 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 small, 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 approachable, so approachable, he looks human, and therefore a worldly person may think, oh, he's one of us. Maybe a better version, a higher grade version of one of us. He's not a higher grade version of one of us. He's not a material imaginary. Can we have the pictures again? Can I? I'm trying to move it. It's not moving. Can you move? Go to the next slide. Can you do it manually? Ah, there he is. Govinda. The tender of the cows and playing upon his flute in the transcendental land of Vrindavan, giving pleasure to the cows, and his whole abode is made up of such activity. He's almighty, but he's in this very simple setting. And this is not like one of the many. This is his original setting, along with Nanda and Yashoda and Balaram, enjoying pastimes with his beloved cows and cowherd boys and gopis and the river Jamuna and the peacocks and the land of Vrindavan. This is our beloved Krishna. That's what this first verse is describing. So any comments or questions? Yes.
In the beginning of the class, you said Paribhasha Sutra. There are this chapter 5, the fifth chapter is encompasses 100 chapters. A question or this thing, why, how can the fifth chakra be that, not the first or something like that? Because
that's how Brahma composed it. Like that, I'm not sure what your question is. Why isn't it earlier? Why isn't it chapter 1? Why is it chapter 5 instead of chapter 1 or 2 or 3 or 4?
Yes.
Why is it 5?
Generally, it would be first one.
That's okay. It doesn't have to be the first one. The Paribhasya Sutra for the Bhagavatam is chapter 3. The Paribhasya Sutra for Nectar Devotion is in the second, the first section in part 2. So it's not essential. It's in the beginning, but it's not necessarily the first verse. It's in the beginning. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. I have heard a verse in Chaitanya Charitamrita that Krishna is the master and everybody else is his servant. So I'm asking if the Vishnu forms, they also, do they have like a servitor like tendency towards Krishna?
Of course. Yes. All entities, including, and their service is creation. Of the cosmic manifestation. They are expansions of Mahasankarshan of the Vaikuntha realm, who is an expansion of Sankarshan of the Goloka realm, who is an expansion of Balaram, who is an expansion of Krishna. So the mood of Balaram, as we're going to hear more, as in service to Krishna, unlimitedly abundant mood of service to Krishna, the Vishnu forms bear the same mood. Okay? Anything else? Yes?
So, is there like one best chapter that everyone should learn from Bhagavad Gita?
One best chapter? Is that what you're asking? That's it. We're reading it. Chapter 5. That's the best chapter. By the way, it's the only one that's known also. It's known, I don't know the detail. It's known that there's 99 other ones. Where they are, as far as I know, they're lost. But somehow chapter 5 is known. Lord Chaitanya, we heard yesterday, Lord Chaitanya found it at the Adikeshava temple in South India. He made copies and distributed to others. But it's the best. According to Jiva Goswami, whose authority we accept. It is the Paribhasha chapter of the other 99. Okay? Do you have something online?
Online, I don't. But there are 64 people watching.
Questions or no? Not yet.
No questions.
Okay. Yes.
When you were reading it, you said that gopis are also the extension of goddess of fortune.
No, the other way around. The goddesses of fortune are expansions of the gopis. Because Krishna is the original, and Radha is his counterpart, the gopis are expansions of Radha. That's in that central part. The yellow part. And we're going to hear the red part, the petals, are the abodes of the gopis. Now, Krishna expands. He expands as Balaram. Balaram expands, and Balaram has his female energy. And then, in the white area around the red lotus, that Sweta Dweep, where Vasudev Sankarshan Prajumna Anadi Ruda, we're ahead of ourselves. But they reside there, in those four quadrants. You see the things on the left side, upside, right side and down. Those are the abodes of the Chaturvyuha. From Sankarshan of the Chaturvyuha, going down in that chart on the left, Sankarshan extends as Narayana, who has the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi. And Lakshmi expands as so many Lakshmis. But going back, just as Radha is the counterpart of Krishna, Lakshmi is the counterpart of Narayana. So we can say Narayana is an expansion of Krishna, the Lakshmis are expansions of the gopis, who are expansions of Radha. Got it? So now your question.
We know that past time where Lakshmi Devi wanted to go and see the Rasleela.
Not only see it, enter into.
Enter into that, and she entered through the chest in the money, something like that.
No. I don't know what stories you're reading. But here's what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Venkata Bhatta discussed in Sri Rangam. Lord Chaitanya asked Venkata Bhatta, what is it about the goddess of fortune? She's leaving the side of Narayana and wants to go and enjoy with Krishna? She's supposed to be chaste. And Venkata Bhatta said, there's no problem because Krishna and Narayana, they're the same. But it's not unchaste. So Lord Chaitanya said, very well, but according to scripture, she underwent austerities for thousands of years and still could not enter the rasa dance. If they're the same, why is the goddess of fortune undergoing austerities to achieve something she doesn't have and then she still could not enter? And Venkata Bhatta said, I don't know, but I think you know. So can you explain? And then Lord Chaitanya said, because the goddess of fortune was thinking of herself as a goddess of fortune. I'm the consort of the all-opulent Narayana. And that mood doesn't work in rasa dance. She couldn't let go of that mood, that identity of herself, even with austerities. But there is a way, and the way is by getting the mercy of the residents of Vrindavan, one can enter into the pastimes of Krishna in Vrindavan. That's the way, not austerities, even if you're the goddess of fortune. It's by receiving the mercy of the residents of Vrindavan, which is exactly the teachings of Rupa Goswami. To enter into the realm of Krishna, one must get the mercy of the residents of Vrindavan. Read Nectar Devotion carefully and you'll find. One must associate with ragatmika bhaktas in order to develop raga. It's not just by vidhis, by following standards and rules. That's going to purify. But to enter in Vrindavan, one must approach this other position. So the eternal associates of Krishna, the perfected souls, who are in that realm of Vrindavan, one needs their mercy. That's what Lord Chaitanya and Venkata Bhatta discussed. And by that, the position of Krishna is unique. Even the goddess of fortune, going down in that chart on the left, she's the goddess, Lakshmi, associate of Narayana. She can't enter. Although Krishna and Narayana are now different because of the mood. Seeing opulence primary instead of the sweetness primary. Sweetness so strong, madhurya so strong, that it eclipses Aishwarya. That's the mood of Vrindavan. And one needs the mercy of the residents of Vrindavan to enter into that mood, and thus to enter into Vrindavan.
Very nice, isn't it? That answers your question. Okay.
This is an online question.
Okay. Go ahead, just say it.
So, the question is from Subra Mataji. She asks, how the understanding of this words, how does it help us in our chanting effectively?
Who is it that we're chanting? The answer is, who is it that we're chanting to? That the when Lord Chaitanya descended, the external reason for his appearance was to give the means of deliverance, the Yuga Dharma, which he did. But there's 999 other Kali Yuga avatars who deliver the holy name, and they're not delivering that same mood of Vrindavan which Lord Chaitanya was freely giving to unqualified people. And so that very special Mahavadanyaya avatar, Lord Chaitanya, was giving the mood of the residents of Vrindavan by understanding that it is Govinda, he who resides in that yellow part of the chart up top on the picture here, and we're going to see some other images where this is also discussed. It's that's the person that we're chanting the name of. It's Hare Krishna, but just as in this verse, Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda. It's that feature of Krishna. It's Govinda. It's Krishna in Vrindavan who were chanting the name of, and whose name is not different than him. That's the mercy that Lord Chaitanya is giving through the chanting, and understanding this will help us understand who it is that we're chanting the name of. Whose name is it we're chanting? Whose name and he are not different? It's like I said at the very beginning, Brahma Samhita is like a lens with which to see the spiritual world, or see the scriptures, in this case see the holy name. It's like, so put the lens in really sharp focus and it's Govinda. Radha Govinda standing in the center, giving us the opportunity through the chanting of the holy name directly and further to associate with him. And specifically, we're going to hear this further in texts 3 and 4 about the mantra that's within that yellow portion in the middle, the hexagonal region of Goloka. It's specifically the Lord of the Gopis, Gopinath. We'll hear some more as we go along. Nandasutta, you have something? One question.
Maharaj, this last paragraph of the first paragraph, the purport, you know, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati is using the word oversoul. And is there any other connotation? Or it's just the name of the super soul which Srila Prabhupada uses?
It's the same as the super soul. Upa drashta, in the language of Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13. Upa drashta, overseer, oversoul, supersoul.
Maharaj, two more questions on that.
Yeah, okay.
Anand Bhadwani Prabhu asks, the ultimate cause of all causes, when it comes to creation and things within the creation, it's easy to understand. But things like my slackening in my services, how can Krishna be the cause?
Things like what? Say, read slower.
But things like my slackening in my services,
yeah.
How can Krishna be the cause of it? How do I understand?
Krishna is the Anumanta. He is the permitter. We're tiny, fragmental parts of Krishna. This is going to come up in one of the verses of Brahma Samhita. But we know from Bhagavad Gita, the individual souls are angsas. They're tiny, fragmental parts. So as Krishna has unlimited free will, the tiny parts have tiny free will. Slackening is misuse of free will, or weakening of the proper use of free will. So where do we get the ability to properly apply ourselves or slacken? From the same place everything else comes from Krishna. It's like another way of saying the same thing. Prahlad Maharaj is speaking to his father, who wanted to know, where are you getting your power from? Prahlad's answer was, from the same place you're getting your power. Vishnu. You're getting your power from Vishnu. I'm getting my power from Vishnu. Because he's the source of all power. So the power of slackening comes from the Supreme Lord. Without his sanctioning, there's nothing we can do. We're dependent upon him. He's independent and we're dependent. So even the slackening, the capacity to do that, comes from him. And then the sanctioning. So then we slacken, and then things start to happen because of our slackening. He doesn't interfere with the choice, but the capacity to make the choice is a capacity given by him. It's part of him. Go ahead.
Thank you, Maharaj. The last question is from Sri Babu Prabhu. He asks, a living entity by design has the power to conquer Maya. Has Bhakti Siddhanta ever told this in Brahma Samhita purports?
No. The premise is a concoction. And so the conclusion is similar. We don't have the power to do anything, conquer Maya or anything else. We don't have that power. Krishna has that power. Anything else?
Actually, there's a follow-up question.
No, same person?
From Anand Vathani Prabhu.
Okay.
Same person who have already asked.
Okay.
Wonderful. The other curiosities I have is about the prayer's name, Sri Brahma Samhita. Part 1, why is it Brahma and not Brahma? And what is the literal meaning of Samhita?
Samhita means like song, or the English translation sometimes is hymn. It has a Christian connotation, but a song of glorification. And I don't understand the first part. It's Brahma. It's Lord Brahma. It's Brahma Samhita. That's what it is. It's his song or glorification of Krishna. Do you understand the question? Radha Krishna? I didn't understand the question.
I think in the first part he wants to know what Brahma is.
Lord Brahma.
Yeah.
Chaturmukha Brahma, the creator of the universe. So that's what the word Brahma refers to, is the creator of our universe, Lord Brahma. We're going to hear more about Lord Brahma, a whole bunch more. It's his best pronunciation. It's Brahma Samhita. Okay? Let me see. Brahma Samhita. Anyways, Lord Brahma.
question which we hear sometimes in our new discovery or some classes.
Okay.
When we say the Lord is Supreme Father, the standard question is that God is not male or female. So we want to explain it in a way which is appropriate. We understand obviously what the truth is, that He is Supreme and everybody else is actually female, all Prakriti. But I was trying to think of what is the right way to explain to the new audience who may not, because we don't want to say God is neither male or female, or is both male and female. So what is the right way to say
that? It depends on the person you're speaking to, the answer that you would give. That's my take on it. But depending upon the person, one might say the Vedic conception is there's Purusha and there's Prakriti. And Purusha is Krishna. Purusha having the connotation of the enjoyer, and Prakriti having the connotation of that which is enjoyed. Because they're actually one entity, Purusha and Prakriti, just like Radha Krishna is not two entities but one entity. When we say he or female gender, excuse me, male gender, it's not in this worldly male female. It's a transcendental. Please lift your consciousness up to the transcendental perspective and consider just like the sun and the sunshine. Is there such a thing as sunshine without sun? Or is there such a thing as sun without sunshine? The answer is no. They're inextricable. But that which is the source of the sunshine is Purusha. And the shine is Prakriti. So we refer to God as Purusha, or He, the energetic. But the energetic doesn't exist without the energy. So it's implicit that Krishna is Radha Krishna. Krishna isn't alone, and Radha isn't alone anymore. The sun and sunshine are separate. It's a Vedic way of describing the energetic source of all things. And the energetic is always accompanied by energy. No, so depending on the person, they may end up just scratching their head after hearing that.
So, I'm saying simply.
Well, the answer is, please take your conceptions off of the material and take them to the transcendental platform. So what I've just described, which is causing you to scratch your head, is the transcendental picture. So when we use he, it is in a transcendental sense of he, not in the worldly sense of he and she. The problem that the struggle that you're having is you don't like discrimination. Because in this world there's he and she kinds of discrimination. So please just put that on hold or kick it to the side or put it in the wastebasket, and let's go to the transcendental conception. He is used in the transcendental sense. Now, you're not there yet. You're still thinking, well, I don't like the he-she thing. But it's because you're stuck with a material conception. And the problem is because you're stuck with a material conception. And there's abusiveness in this world of material conceptions. You don't like that either. We don't like it either. So let's move to the transcendental conception, the spiritual conception. And that's the meaning. Let's go there. Come on, let's leave that one behind and we'll go to the spiritual one. And they may still be going, yeah, but... You know, yeah, but... Come on, let go of it. Yeah, but stuff. And let's go to the spiritual conception. Yes.
So, Maharaj, following Bhagavan Prabhu's question, so
Can we just say in one word that it's a transcendental gender, it's a transcendental gender where Krishna is both mother and father?
That's maybe a simpler. Okay, so Krishna means Radha and Krishna. We say he, it means he and she. Because energy is without it, is not without energetic. Excuse me. An energetic is not without energy. So we say he is both. Just take it that way.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's the altar. We may speak of, we're worshipping Krishna. But it's Radha Krishna. And depending upon the person, you can say some other things. We'll hear something about Mahavishnu. And he has his Rama Devi, but she's within. Normally, Radha and Krishna is external. But with Rama and Mahavishnu, she's within. And he's enjoying pastimes with her within, in Yoga Nidra. That's why you don't see her, because she's within. But they're inseparable. Well, the energetic and the energy are in one form or in two forms. There's still the energetic and the energy. We'll end there. Srila Prabhupada ki. Huh? I don't know. What time would you recommend?
We announce 9:30.